sometimes in life, the bad guy turns out to be good. Especially when he's doing a crazy Ivan. Right, Shipwreck? Sometimes the good guys end up actually being good. Here on the Prop History Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Prop History Podcast. My name is Mike.
I'm Greg.
And we generally talk about props.
Yeah.
From movie, TVs, film, theater, etc.
Yes.
This podcast is, of course, sponsored by...
What's the name of them?
Prop Store.
Prop Store of London. I always say Prop Store of London because that's what they were originally. PropStore.com, both in Los Angeles and London.
You can find them at PropStore.com or PropStore.uk for all of their all of your propping needs. Currently, they have a Mythbusters auction going on. And then after that, the special auction that they'll be doing is Star Trek Discovery, which we'll talk about that in a coming episode.
Can't wait for that. The Mythbusters auction looks like it's going gangbusters.
It is going gangbusters. I believe it ends Monday, if I'm not mistaken. So by the time this podcast goes up, it think we'll probably be done.
I'd be curious to see how much Bruce, the big 12-foot, 10-foot shark, is going to go for.
I'd be surprised if it goes for a lot, because huge props like that tend to not go for a lot of money.
Yeah, I thought about buying it, and like I did, started thinking about the logistics of getting here, and then I realized we're going to need a bigger shop.
So. A much bigger shop. And I mean, there's a part of me that wants the absolutely horrifying animatronic cat.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, like... I spent too much money on props recently, and I got Dragon Con coming up and everything else.
Sure, I get that. But you got that really cool mannequin from that one movie, The Wall?
Great Wall that I got from Prop Store.
I suck today. I don't know anything.
That's all good. It's all good. But as you could tell, if you were paying attention by Greg's unbelievably atrocious accent...
That's not what your mother shed last night, Trebek.
We are actually going to be discussing the props, special effects, etc. of the 1990 film Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
Starring Alec Baldwin and Sean Connery.
And Tim Curry's in it. And
Scott
Sam
Glenn.
Neill. And Courtney B. Vance. And
Darth Vader.
Darth Vader is in it. And so is Jeffrey, what's his face? The principal, Mr. Rooney from... Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, he is in that, isn't he? I always forget that he's in there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good actors in that movie. Yeah. But...
Oh, Gates McFadden.
Oh, yeah,
Gates McFadden
is in it, yeah.
She has one line.
Yeah, she has one line in the whole thing.
In
and
an
two
English
glasses
accent.
Of water. One story, two glasses of water. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Is that her actual accent? She's not British, is she?
She's American.
Yeah, she's American. Huh.
Cheryl McFadden.
Oh, is that her real name?
Yep, Cheryl Gates McFadden. So when she does dancing stuff, it's Cheryl McFadden. And when she does TV stuff, it's Gates McFadden.
Interesting.
There you go.
Fair enough. You'd feel like Gates would be the name she'd use with dancing.
Because
when you walk, it's your gait.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
See? Went a long way for that shit
right.
joke.
Maybe she uses it for when she shows horses.
Could be, yeah. So before we finally eventually find our way to talking about
or
this
make
movie.
Fences.
Sven, what have you been working? Did you do anything new? Did you get anything new?
Yeah, I just got in the Hasbro Star Wars Mandalorian Black Series Mandalorian helmet. And I got to say, for a $125 toy, this is spiffy.
Yeah, it's actually sitting on the table as we're doing this podcast. And it is actually, for what it is, and I own a few of the Black Series helmets, and for what they are, when you break them down to it, that they're toys, it's pretty good. The finish on it's honestly kind of impressive for what it is, and it looks like you expect it to look. It looks like Din Djarin's helmet.
Yep, I'm very happily going to put this on my wall with the rest of my helmets. So.
There you go. Are you going to cosplay as Din Djarin eventually?
I'm 5'4 and fat. No. I'm not going to cosplay as anybody. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody should do what they're comfortable with, and I am very pro, you know, like, do you, and I don't, I just don't feel comfortable cosplaying many characters because of my height and stature, and I would just as soon be that cheerleader on the side for anybody that's wants to do that. And
well, anyone can cosplay as anything.
I agree, so absolutely.
You could cosplay as Darth Vader.
not going to do that.
But you could.
I could. I absolutely could.
There are no rules that say that your body proportions have to match the body proportions of the character you're portraying.
I know. I'm just insecure. I mean, that's the honest to God
truth. That's fair. That's fair.
I would rather be here cheerleading other people to make them not feel insecure. So.
Fair enough. That's why you're a good person.
I try. I wish I was better, but I thank you.
So back in ye oldie times of 1990, there was kind of an era in films that kind of started with Hunt for Red October. It was all these Cold War spy thrillers that started coming out, and a lot of them focused around Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
And there was a whole series of Jack Ryan films that came out, but only one of them starred, in my opinion, the perfect Jack Ryan.
I agree.
Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
Because I think he portrayed the character so well. And when he was actually brought on for this film, he was really kind of an up-and-coming actor. Nobody really knew who he was at the time.
Beetlejuice.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. Beetlejuice and a couple of other films. But he wasn't a big star yet. He wasn't the big star Alec Baldwin that we know today.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them. And you're always going to love Harrison Ford. But, like, to me, Alec Baldwin is Jack Ryan.
Yeah, he does a really good job at it. And the making of this film, when you start to look into the backstory of like all the production problems that they had and all the technology that was actually developed for this film, you start to realize that it's fantastic in all the leaps and bounds they made, but they also did a lot of stuff in really old school ways, because all of the submarine shots, everything was models, which is near and dear to my heart. We've discussed this before. Yeah. The filming models are my thing.
I was watching this last night. I mean, I've seen this movie 20 times, but you know, every once in a while I do like to revisit them before we talk about them.
Right.
And I was blown away how believable 98% of it was.
Yeah, the effects hold up today. And that is, I think, part of it. Are you talking about the storyline?
No, well, yeah, the storyline, but no, I mean like the effects and the sets, and like I know in my head that they were filming on a set, you mm-hmm. know. I know in my head that these were models in the water, and water is one of my pet peeves about movies and models, is that you can't scale water.
Mm-mm.
Water is always the same scale. So if you put a toy submarine in real water, the water is too big for, and like I was watching it with my wife, and there's the scene where they blow up the other attack sub.
The Konovalov?
Yes, the Konovalov. And that's a great word.
The Akula-class submarine.
And, like, Becky's like, did they blow up a real submarine? I'm like, no, I'm sure they didn't. But, you know, like, it, like, for her to, like, after sitting there watching movies with me for 11 years, for her to ask a question like that, it's like, they did a good job.
Would you like to hear something that might actually kind of bake your noodle a little bit?
Sure.
None of those scenes with submarines was filmed in water.
Really?
Not a bit of it. It was all lighting in a massive soundstage, and they used a specially designed gimbal that was actually originally designed for Batteries Not Included to get the submarines to move the way they did.
Oh, wow.
And would you like to take a guess at how large the filming model for The Hunt for Red October was?
I think I've seen pictures of it. I want to say like 12, 15 feet long.
It was like 22 feet
long.
Oh,
wow.
It was enormous. It was big enough for three people to lay head to toe in of the length of the submarine. And it was built like, essentially it was built like a float so that they could make it lightweight. The whole thing, as big as it was like 300 pounds. And it was all like originally it was made, like all the submarine models were originally made by Boss Studios, who did a lot of stuff for Ghostbusters and a whole bunch of other movies. And then they went over to ILM to do a lot of the finishing work on them. And the Red October herself, the full size, like the large filming model, because they did actually build part of the full size Hunt for Red October for some scenes, for like when the crew was being removed from the boat or when she's being towed out of the Polyarny Inlet and all that. But that full size submarine model, that 22-foot long submarine, only weighed 300 pounds, and it was made out of like vacuum form panels and an aluminum frame. Huh. And that was pretty much it.
Now, does that still survive?
I have not found anything that says it's still around. Some of the smaller filming models, because they made multiple sizes of models of the Red October and the Los Angeles and the Akula class Konovalov.
Dallas. Los Angeles class.
It was Los Angeles class, but it was the Dallas. It was actually, but when they actually.
The Big D.
With Big D. But some of the stuff that they filmed was actually on board a real ballistic or a real attack submarine. It was the USS Salt Lake City.
Oh, cool.
So they actually did get to do some filming with a real submarine. Exterior shots only, none of the interior stuff.
See, that's the thing that just blew me away watching it was these interior shots. Like, I've never been in a nuclear submarine, but, like, in my mind, this is exactly what it looked like, and it felt cramped. And
oh, yeah. And it's great because, like, the sets for the Los Angeles class, the Dallas and the Red October, were actually the same set. They switched certain panels around.
Oh, wow.
And changed the lighting. Because if you pay attention, each submarine had its own specific lighting to set them apart from each other. Because the Dallas was primarily red lighting. The Konovalov was primarily green, and the Red October was primarily blue.
Interesting.
So that's how they kind of set them apart. But both submarine interiors, the Los Angeles class and the Red October, they were both essentially the same set and on a massive gimbal at the Paramount Studios so that it could rock back and forth 45 degrees in any direction.
I think one of the amazing scenes to me was just that scene where the October is turning and the coffee or the teacup, I guess, probably starts sliding.
Yeah.
And Sean Connery just catches it with such grace.
And that was real. That wasn't somebody standing on, that wasn't, you know, somebody off scene, like pulling the glass. That was actually them just rotating that gimbal so that the teacup would slide. And that whole thing moved. And the best part was, is that the prop department, they rigged that thing up so that the controls would, like the dials and stuff, mm-hmm. would actually react to the actor's input.
Oh, that's cool.
So when I don't know what you call them, truth be told, the sub drivers on board the Los Angeles, when they, on board the Dallas, when they dive, when they push those yokes forward to make it dive, those dials are reacting to them.
Oh, that's
so awesome. Everything on board worked. They did a huge amount of work to make the interiors of those submarines as accurate as they could, you know, within reason, because nobody really knew what the inside of the Red October would look like, a Typhoon class submarine.
I was totally sold.
Yeah. And the Konovalov was actually filmed on, some of the scenes in the Konovalov were actually filmed on board a real submarine.
Oh, nice.
It was a diesel boat that they used, a diesel submarine that they actually used for some of the interior shots of the Konovalov.
Now, and those exterior shots, like when the crew is off boarding like, do you know where those were filmed?
I believe it was primarily filmed in Great Britain. Okay. But that scene, like where it's submerging, that mm-hmm. scene where the first time they filmed that, they lost all the cameras that were on the deck because they weren't prepared for how quickly it would submerge, and they ended up like dropping several cameras into the ocean, and they're gone for forever. But it was that
we get Jim Cameron to go look for him,
right? And it was cool, like that scene where they had the foul weather and everything, where these guys are trying to get on lifeboats and stuff. That was all created by a bunch of tugboats driving around really fast to get the waves, and some of them had fog machines and all this other stuff spraying onto this section of this Typhoon-class submarine they built specifically for those shots. And it was towed. When you see, like, Sean Connery and the doctor from Jurassic Park up in the conning tower as it's being towed out in the opening scene of the movie, those tugboats that are with it are actually towing it.
Oh, that's cool.
Because it's just a section of the submarine, and that's all that they built.
Do you think they'll let me live in Montana?
Montana, yeah. He's going to raise rabbits, I think, what he's going to do.
Yes, and find a plump American woman with a pickup truck.
No, because I love filming models, I looked into this movie a lot for the filming models of it, because Boss Studios made all the models for this initially. And the Konovalov, of course, is the Akula-class submarine that we're talking about here. When they made that thing, they made it 2 scales, 1/20th scale, I think, is what they made it to. It was a 4-foot-long model. And they made the beautiful model, perfectly detailed, exact to scale in every way, shape, and form. And the director came in and said, "This thing looks great. Cut 2 inches out of the center of it so it looks meaner." They'd already made the molds, everything. So all of that work down the toilet, because they had to go in and saw out the 2-inch section from the center of the submarine and then remake all the molds and everything. Now that still survives. As does, I think it's a 12-foot model of the Red October, actually sold on a prop store not too long ago, a few years ago, really. And the filming model for the Dallas, I would think its 4-foot filming model still survives as well. But I just love that so much of that, there's none of that shots were done under actual water.
That's awesome. It was. I mean, I absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of shots, like the torpedo shots that were like, but you know, like
it's the 90s.
It was 90s. It was 1990, and I think, you know, thinking about like the fact of when it happened, like in other movies of the time period, and like it's really one of the few movies of this genre where like there's no romance angle. There's no, it's just out and out espionage and action, and like there's none of the superfluous stuff. And I was surprised how much I kind of enjoyed that. Like,
yeah, there was no extras. It was just, this is the story, and we're going to focus on that, and that's going to be it.
Yeah.
And I loved, like, all of the side characters were super believable. Everything about it was really believable.
I love Fred Thompson.
Yeah.
Like, the whole scene.
Ruskies don't take a dump without a plan, son. One of the best lines from the whole movie.
I love when Fred Thompson was the captain of the Enterprise, if you're just following along and don't know what I'm talking about, but Fred Thompson later went on to be a senator from the great state of Tennessee till his death, I believe. But I love the scene where, you know, the commander is like, I don't like the fact that he's wearing a uniform. And Fred Thompson's like, that boy, you know, finished his fourth year of the Naval Academy in a bed after all, you know, this whole scene. And it's like, you might want to cut him a little slack. And I'm like, I like that bit of depth that it gave Jack Ryan's character and the credibility. And it further explains so much about, like, why this doctor, this analyst, is willing to jump into the, you know, North Atlantic in the middle of the night and nearly drown just because he believes it so much, because that's who his personality was from the get-go. Like,
yeah,
this is who he was at 18.
Yeah, his character development is subtle, but it's there. And, like, they don't go into this huge backstory about how he's this huge super badass or anything like that. But he does have a lot of different skill sets that they don't put up front. But they kind of hint at them throughout the movie. And you kind of get the sense that he is capable of a lot of things. Which I think they did a really good job of that with Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
And then they brought in Harrison Ford to play the character Jack Ryan. And then everybody's like, oh, it's Harrison Ford. Of course he can do that.
Right.
Indiana Jones.
I think, but, you know, Alec Baldwin, I mean, he really gave that character a huge arc.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from going to being afraid to sleeping on a plane because of turbulence to being passed out next to a teddy bear on the way home. Like, I know I'm not talking really much about the props and stuff, but I was just really blown away how 21 years later, like, I still really love this movie for the same reasons I loved it 21 years ago.
Yeah, and let's be honest, Greg. I mean, we spend maybe, 10% of this podcast talking about props, but I love it for all of how real it feels.
Yeah.
The whole story feels very real, and that, you know, there's not this, there's none of these over-the-top ridiculous sets to try and mimic military equipment other than the submarines, because they did actually get a lot of support from the Department of Defense when they made this.
Yeah.
Like, they did actually get access to a destroyer to film, like, to do some of the filming with that destroyer and with an actual nuclear attack submarine.
Do you know where, like, the building, you know, the scene where we meet Jeffrey Jones's character at the sub yard at the dock, was that filmed at a real?
I believe it was actually filmed at a sub yard. From what I can tell, that it actually was filmed at Norfolk.
Okay.
Or at least it was like Boston Navy Yard, something like that. Because it was actually a sub dry dock, and that was a sub in dry dock. So that was an actual submarine.
Yeah, that would be an expensive set to build.
That was a ridiculous set to have to build.
Yeah.
But instead, I believe that was an actual dry dock that may have actually been at Norfolk.
We're going to start building a real sub and then just...
we're going to build a whole submarine for a two-minute scene. Dunskies. I mean, honestly, that's not the most ridiculous thing ever in Hollywood.
Nah.
Because they did build an entire city once for 3 weeks of filming over the period of 7 months and then dynamited it when they were done.
Cecil.
Good old Cecil B. DeMille. Hate that guy.
So, props.
Props, yeah.
There was a scene, the scene where Jonesy is listening on the reel-to-reel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was funny to think about, like, 21 years later, like, that would all be digital.
Every bit would be digital,
There would be no analog. Anything.
Well, that was kind of at the cusp between analog and digital, too, because that era was where analog was starting to be phased out and digital was starting to take over everything. But the military, I mean, hell, we still use floppy disks for our ballistic missile forces.
Oh,
so, because the equipment is
pedigreed. Five and a quarters or three and a half?
I think it's five and a quarter or three and a half. I don't remember which one it is, but they still use floppy disks because the equipment doesn't break. It's pedigreed over the last 30 years, and you can't hack it.
Yeah.
So it's not really connected to the internet. It's just all internal systems, but they still use 3.5-inch floppy disks.
Just because got to make sure you put in the right disk and don't accidentally put in Oregon Trail.
Right. That would be funny if it was Oregon Trail. But at the same time, they did finally change the codes on the missiles because they used to be 00000.
That's funny.
Yeah. For the longest time, that was the codes for every missile in the United States. But then somebody leaked that, and then they got changed.
Things I didn't learn from Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Love the Bomb.
I love that movie. It's so good.
I taught that last year. That was funny.
Speaking of sets built to be accurate to military equipment, that B-52 that they built for Dr. Strangelove, which was later used in Dawn's Early Light with Powers Booth, was so accurate that the Department of Defense actually looked like they went to Stanley Kubrick and said, how did you get this so accurate? Because you're not supposed to know all this stuff about that. And a lot of the equipment that they use, like the CRM-114, yeah. That was all made up for the movie. But they actually did get B-52 crewmen, you know, that were out of the military at that point, to basically like, how's this look? What does this look like? What does that look like? And they did the same thing with the submarine interiors, but with the help of the Department of Defense, they were actually able to go on board a submarine, not take pictures, but look around and draw sketches and get it as accurate as they possibly could.
So you know what the big connection between Dr. Strangelove and Hunt for Red October is?
What?
James Earl Jones.
He was in both of them. Yes, that's right. Because I believe he's the bombardier.
Yep.
But yeah, oh wow. Yeah, he is in both of them. Look at that. Two degrees of James Earl Jones in this case. That's fantastic.
I don't know where that came from, but
It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. So as far as other filming models go, the only other one that really sticks out is the DSRV, the little rescue submarine. And that was a 4-foot model by itself because the scenes...
Why not just make it full size at that point?
Well, they did make a full size one for the scene where they were where they were craning it down in the dry dock. But they made a 4-foot filming model for the scene where it connects to the Red October. And the way that, like, I love the way they filmed those scenes because they had this massive model of the Red October. But because of the cameras at the time, they couldn't get the super close shots that they wanted while it swept over the deck, like coming in real close to the deck of the submarine and all that as, you know, they're doing these big shots. Because if they pulled the camera back, the model would just look like a model. You'd lose that sense of scale. So they actually set up a almost prism mirror that they could run the mirror along the deck of the submarine, and actually did scrape it on the way down, and then the camera would film through that mirror. So they used a series of mirrors to actually film those scenes to get that sense of scale, which I absolutely love the little details about how these movies are made and all the different tricks that they have to use.
I remember thinking when they open the hatch they dock on top of the ship, and then the guy gets with the big hammer.
The ball peen, yeah. Just like,
and I'm like waiting for the Russians to go, we just make this. You scratch up our ship already?
Yeah.
Like, what kind of people are you?
I feel like if a ball peen hammer could damage the hull of a submarine, that would be a problem.
Let me see your proof of insurance.
Right?
I take this to body shop.
There's a part of me that really wants somebody to go back and overdub that with as soon as they open it, like, we've been trying to get a hold of you about your car's extended warranty. For months now.
Oh, yes, you are here. Good. We have been trying to get a hold of you about your car insurance, your extended warranty.
So we've talked about the filming models.
Yes.
We've talked about the sets. Yeah. We've talked about pretty much every prop there is in this movie, except for the scene with the baby Ruth.
The baby Ruth?
Yeah, that industrial waste type puke when he's on board the E2C Hawkeye.
Oh, is that what he was eating? Yeah, was a baby Ruth?
Yeah. So I love that scene for a lot of reasons. One, because it shows just, you know, one service member fucking with another service member just to do it, essentially, in that guy's eyes, that crewman's eyes. And this is just a naval officer who looks sick on board a plane, and now he's making it worse for fun. That's all it is.
I had no idea it was a baby Ruth.
Yeah, it was a baby Ruth that he's eaten. And they're just, I love that entire interior, that was a decommissioned E-2C Hawkeye, the observation aircraft used by the Navy for... I think it can reach out 250 miles with its radar.
My friend Frank used to fly those.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, that's cool. But they actually did film that in a decommissioned E2C Hawkeye, which is really cool. It was one that was in a museum, and they filmed those scenes inside the museum, and it was all just camera tricks to show the turbulence, which I thought was awesome. But I do love that scene so much.
I had no idea that was...
Oh, you want to talk about puke?
No, I remember why. I just, like, it didn't occur to me that what he was eating. And now, like, of course, you know, my mind, when a baby Ruth is always going to be Caddyshack.
Caddyshack, yeah. Duty.
And then Bill Murray.
He's like, it's okay. And just starts eating it, and the lady passes out. Oh. Well, man, we've managed to go from Hunter Hard October to Caddyshack.
We do these things.
Yeah, we do.
Hey, at least we're still talking about movies.
We are still talking about movies. That's sort of a first for us, and we're, what, almost a half an hour in.
Holy crap.
Good Lord. We haven't deviated that much at all.
No. Well, I mean, it does help. It's a movie like we both have watched like within the last 24 hours.
Yeah, and a movie that we actually both really like.
Yes.
And, I mean, obviously, you love it for your reasons, and I love it for my reasons, but we both appreciate it for what it is. And that the fact that the movie, even though it is 30 years old, still holds up.
Yeah,
really, really well. And all of the actors, all of the acting in it is fantastic, no matter what the scene is. Even Stanley does a really good job, the stuffed bear. And I love that interaction with Alec Baldwin and James Earl Jones. Who's Stanley? Stanley's a bear.
Yeah. I mean, in that moment where his little CIA brain is
like, who's Stanley?
We missed something.
Right?
How does that happen?
And I always, the first time I saw that and like realized that he was suspicious, I'm like, what's he suspicious about? What is there to be suspicious about? And it didn't occur to me many watches later, that it was like it was something he didn't know about Jack's life. Like, because he probably knew everything about Jack's life.
CIA.
So, and it was just that CIA side of him, that naval intelligence side of him. Like, I don't know what that is. And maybe that's where the suspicion comes from. But I love that
tidbit. I just love the nuance that James Earl Jones brought to the movie, especially like that scene right before they detonate the torpedo.
I was sniffing here.
And you just see his black hand and that gold ring, and like, you know who it is, because he's the, you know, outside of Jonesy, he's the only African American person in this.
Yeah.
And you're like, he's gonna do something cool because it's James Earl Jones.
Right.
James Earl Jones does cool things.
Yeah, something badass and clandestine is about to happen, and that's exactly what happened. They blew up the torpedo before it hit.
Yeah.
And I just loved, like, you heard it hit the hall. I was never here. Shows his ID and bounces.
Right.
Deuces, yo.
Yep. There's so many of those good scenes in this movie. And it is also kind of a good sort of look into the tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States at that time, too. Because it's supposed to take place in 1984.
Right.
And in that time period, we were at each other's throats.
Well, I mean, by then, you know, what else was going on? Oh, well, no, I guess they hadn't been flipped off by American pilots inverted over a MiG-28.
Not yet. So that was 87 when that happened. But right before that, they had just gotten kicked out of Afghanistan. The Soviets had. So that had just happened. And then they were trying to come back from that. And there was lots of saber rattling going on at the time, a lot of politicking. And Reagan was going out of his way to bankrupt the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was playing along. So there was all this tension going on between our two countries at that time. And in 1984, I believe we were at March Air Force Base in California. I think that's where we were at that time. And I still remember the preparedness test launches, where they would launch every B-52 on the base and every F-4 Phantom, called them Alpha launches, and they would launch them all just to test how quick they could get up in the air in the event of an attack. Like, that was a real thing at the time, and it is kind of like a kind of a peek into how tense everything was.
It is, you know, looking at that time period of movies, like, you know, when you think about this and you think of Red Dawn,
mm-hmm.
or you think of, you know, even Top Gun, like, where the Russians are all the bad guys.
They're the baddie, yeah.
And they made such a fun bad guy that was like, you could dislike him. It wasn't culturally insensitive to dislike them.
The Russians, yeah. And it's still, and they weren't the Nazis.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't pure evil, but
they were just bad.
They weren't great either.
Yeah.
Because they were, I mean, they were the bad guy in every movie almost. Because you had, Firefox and all the Rambo series was all Russians. There were Russians in Predator. How many different movies had Russians as bad guys in one way or another?
Rocky IV.
The worst of them all, truth be told. If he dies, he dies. Killed Apollo Creed, the son of a bitch.
Bastard. I will never forgive Dolph Lundgren for that.
For making the movie?
No, for killing Apollo Creed.
He didn't really die. Oh. Carl Weathers did not really die in that movie.
So the guy that looks just like him but older on Mandalorian?
Yeah. No, it's the same dude. Oh, it's, okay. Yeah, it's okay. He didn't actually die.
Well, that makes me feel better. Although, I got to be honest, it took me years to stop hating Jason Alexander for his role of Philip Stuckey in Pretty Woman.
Really?
Like, yeah. He played that.
Oh, he was scummy as hell in
that
movie.
He was so horrible in that movie. Yeah. Like, scummy horrible that, like I would watch Seinfeld for that first season or two. And I'm like, fuck you, Philip Stuckey.
Right? You're disgusting, you horrible creature.
Yeah. Then I saw him on Saturday, or no, The Tonight Show, and he was like, I'm James Kirk. And I'm like, you're my hero now. Like,
right.
You're making, yeah, like,
you're, so you remember Jurassic Park, of course.
Yeah.
Dennis Nedry.
Yeah.
You remember the actor Dennis Nedry?
Yes.
Who played Dennis Nedry, whose name escapes me at the moment because I'm really bad with names. I've been
Newman.
I've been rewatching Narcos on Netflix.
I thought you were going to say Third Rock from the Sun.
No. Narcos on Netflix, and he plays a lawyer for the drug kingpins, and he's just kind of a scummy, creepy dude. And I'm like, you're not the Dennis Nedry that I hated. You're this scummy lawyer that I hate now, and I'm not comfortable with this. But it's a great, like, showing of...
Yeah, but you know the scummiest character he ever plays?
Who's that?
Al of Big Al's Toys in Toy Story 2.
Oh, yeah, he's awful in that. Yeah. He's actually great in that. But, no, he's a terrible character. It's a well-done character, but I hate him. So, because he ruins everything.
I hate that his name isn't popping up in my head.
I know. So. I should know his name. I've got his raincoat right there, but I don't remember. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter.
Newman.
So... I think we've covered Hunt for Red October as far as the props, the sets, special effects, and the actors go pretty well.
Yeah. Wow, it was a good movie. I
would say that this has been a thorough podcast for the Hunt for Red October.
And probably nobody's going to like it.
Because nobody's going to like it. We didn't ramble like idiots.
Talk about stupid things.
They're like, they're staying on point. Click, turn it off.
Yeah, no, I'm just... No.
Unacceptable. Yeah. Unacceptable. So what else you got going on there?
I've got R2 back on the bench. Mm-hmm. I've got one of my legs almost done. Mm-hmm. My goal is to have that done by the end of this week so I can start on the other leg. I got a dude coming over Sunday to help me weld together feet.
Nice.
Some of these new TikTok trends are making me cry. These ones where it's like... You know, I'm 17 and I'm 40. And tell me about what happened. Did you marry that guy?
Oh, yeah,
that
shit. Yeah. No, that's killing me.
Yeah.
I hate that. Because I'm like, if I did that, it would just be super depressing. And
right?
I don't want that. Yeah. Nobody wants to see that.
Yeah. Don't do the depressing TikTok things.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah. I got nothing. What about you? What's going on with you?
Well, I'm very nearly done. I finally got properly good models back from my model maker for the... hinges for the Book of the Dead and the Book of Amun-Ra. So they're almost done.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I've started making a whole bunch of foam tools for sale and rental to film productions, and it looks like there's a lot of interest in that.
That piece that you showed me earlier is...
The hammer?
Just amazing.
I made a rubber hammer that looks like a real hammer, and I'm quite proud of it. So now I'm going to make a monkey wrench and a regular wrench and some other tools, and the Nowling can. We had this discussion earlier. Greg had this magnificent suggestion for me to make a food can that can be used to either throw at people or to hit people with, etc., just for stunt purposes in film. And whenever we go to LA, we don't go to LA without going to Earl Hayes Press.
That's
Earl Hayes is amazing. Thank you, Keith, for being so cool if you listen to this. But there's a chance that I may be going back to LA here in a little while. I can't say why yet, because secrecy reasons.
Sure.
And then I'll be going to Earl Hayes and probably picking up a bunch of labels for that. So
give me a Smeet one.
Oh, yeah, we'll get one for Smeet, because that was... I didn't know this. We found this out from our friend Scott Reeder, Scott Prop and Roll on TikTok, that the fake Spam product that you see in films, Smeet, it's a yellow label, says S-M-E-A-T, was actually developed for Waterworld. And it's been in a ton of movies now.
I hate to say it, but I kind of liked Waterworld. Not as much as I loved The Postman. I actually loved The Postman.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, I loved The Postman. I thought it was great.
You cannot see the look of incredulity on my face.
I realize I'm the only one on the planet, but no, I totally loved The Postman.
I'm so disappointed. Honestly, the movie is like a popcorn muncher as far as I'm concerned. It's not a great movie. I will not agree with you.
No, but the guy from Armageddon...
There's a lot of good actors.
Plays the bad guy who used to be a photocopy repair guy.
I mean, the movie's silly. It's silly. I'll be honest, I like Waterworld because it's...
Sure.
It's essentially, it's Kevin Costner playing Kevin Costner versus Dennis Hopper playing Dennis Hopper. But they're in a swimming pool. And it's great. And everything's rusted. And that scene with the quad 50 caliber machine gun was amazing. I absolutely love that scene for some reason.
I got to meet Dennis Hopper when I was a kid. They filmed the movie Hoosiers here in Indiana, in Indianapolis. And I got to go with my mom to the premiere. Oh. And Dennis Hopper was there, and I got to meet him at the premiere.
Well, there is a chance, and I'm still working it through, but there is a chance that I may be able to go to the Ghostbusters
premiere. Oh, my God, that would be so amazing.
So I don't know if it's going to happen yet, but I'm still working out the details. But it may be a thing, but whenever the movie comes out, because everybody's moving opening dates for movies right now.
Yeah,
so
Thanksgiving, is that what we're saying?
Maybe. I think it was early November. But I don't know if it's going to change because every other movie is changing. So we'll see what happens. But hopefully I'll be able to go to the premiere of Ghostbusters Afterlife.
That would be awesome.
And whether it's the fan premiere, which is at the Sony lot, which I honestly wouldn't be mad about, or the red carpet premiere, I don't give a shit. I would just love to go to a movie premiere.
Absolutely.
And this is my way of saying, hey, Sony, invite me to the premiere. So
there you go. Come on, Sony.
I doubt they listen to this podcast. I would be surprised if they did it all. But yeah. That's what I've got going on right now.
Cool.
And, of course, I am still chugging forward on the Ark of the Covenant and an R2. So, and very an nice. R5i9.
I need to do an R5. That's the... But that's the cone-shaped one?
Coned, but flat on the top. Yeah. Yeah, that's what that one is. And that's the one I like. I love the way that head design is. So, that's the one I'm building. And mine that I'm building for myself is just going to be static. He's just going to sit in the corner. But the other one I'm building for a friend of mine.
That reminds me of a story for you after this.
Okay.
Not airworthy.
Not airworthy?
Yeah, nah, it's not important. But no, it's
fair enough. Fair enough. But we are at the 37-minute mark. Do we want to keep...
In a row?
Right. We've been doing this for 37 minutes in a row.
Yeah.
No. And we've somehow managed to stay largely on top.
I say we give everybody a little bit of a break today and let them get back to their lives. And
stop listening to us yammer on about nonsense. Yeah. Okay. Well, Greg, if somebody wanted to find what you're working on the social medias, where would they find you?
On Instagram, it is Props with Greg. Greg with two G's at the end. And on the TikToks, it's What I'm Making.
Well, if you wanted to find out what I'm working on, it's anywhere on social media. At Props to History, and here before long, you'll be able to buy the props that I'm working on at mtsprops.com. Here shortly, that will be going live not too long from now, and on Facebook at What I'm Making. And if you want to follow the podcast, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at History Prop, because turns out Prop History Podcast was taken for some reason on Twitter.
Somebody cyber squat that one?
I think so. And then on the Instagram at Prop History Podcast. This has been the Prop History Podcast.
Bye.
Bye.